From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting via Skype from Managua, Nicaragua. So we can start with the election in Guatemala. It looks like it's going to be going, and it's 97% returns at the time we're recording this, that it's going to be going to the second round in August.
Yeah, and as we were talking about last week, the election in Guatemala in some sense is pretty meaningless, because whoever wins is just going to be faced with a very, very intractable set of economic and political circumstances that are they're unlikely to be able to manage in any a way that positively benefits the majority of people in Guatemala. And so, but just for a change, it looks as though a relatively progressive candidate, Sandra Torres, who's the ex-wife of Alvaro Colom, who was the president, and I think he was president in the period something like 2006 to 2010, something like that. I've forgotten the exact dates. But Alvaro Colom has been the only successful progressive politician to be president of Guatemala for, as far as I can remember, for the last 25, 30 years. The last president that was reasonably successful prior to him was Vinicio Cerezo, who was the president that managed to negotiate an end to the armed conflict in Guatemala. And in fact, he was a key person, far more so than Oscar Arias of Costa Rica. Vinicio Cerezo was the key person in making possible the peace agreement that led to the end of the war in El Salvador, the end of the war in Nicaragua, and the end of the war in his own country, Guatemala. And so he wasn't, in fact, a left-wing politician, but he before Alvaro Colom, he was Guatemala's best president. And so when Alvaro Colom came along, and what he tried to do is implement relatively progressive policies, prioritizing reducing poverty. But he came up against what's that Russian word, nomenklatura, for the entrenched interests, in the state, in the army, among the business sector, generally aligned with the United States. And although he wasn't in any strong sense of the word an anti-imperialist, Alvaro Colom was indeed, he did have some concept of national sovereignty, which of course is anathema to the United States.
Can't have that in the empire.
So, and he, at that time, Sandra Torres was his wife. She was the first lady during Alvaro Colom's presidency. Yeah. And subsequently, they separated. And Sandra Torres, I think this is this may be her third, but it's certainly her second attempt to run as a presidential candidate in Guatemala's national elections. And she, I think last time she came second to Jimmy Morales, the comedian.
Right.
Who turned out to be not so funny.
Right, I know.
The point of view of most people in Guatemala.
Right.
But Sandra Torres, and she's running on a ticket, poverty reduction, more equality for women, and that kind of thing. And she's kind of steering clear of very sensitive stuff like Guatemala's national sovereignty, the role of the army.
Right.
And she herself is being like all the politicians, the politicians that were standing in this presidential election that had a serious chance of winning, they're all kind of tarred with the corruption brush. And there's a single one of the leading candidates in this presidential election that is not under the shadow of some allegation or other of corruption.
Right.
And Thelma Cabrera, who was the indigenous people's candidate, and she was she was one of the handful of candidates that could be regarded as completely clean in that sense. So, Sandra Torres, she's the front runner after the first round, and with something over twice the votes that Giametti got.
Yep. That's interesting because when Jimmy Morales beat her in 2016, it was almost the opposite of that. He had 67% in the final, you know, in the second round, and she had about 33%. So, you know, he had basically twice what she had at that time, and now she comes in the preliminary round with twice the next person.
Yeah, and she may. She may well be the beneficiary of votes that would have gone to two candidates, also both women, by the way, who were disqualified by the electoral tribunal on the grounds of one kind of irregularity or another, and financial corruption or election corruption or misuse of campaign funds or getting campaign funds from where they shouldn't have got them. That kind of stuff. And so the two leading candidates, or the maybe not, at least one of those people was likely to have done better than Sandra Torres, I think.
Right.
But they were disqualified, and the other person was disqualified too, so that left the field clear for Sandra Torres. Was that deliberate? Who knows? But the nitty-gritty is that Sandra Torres is kind of one of the cleaner candidates with some kind of progressive vision aimed at poverty reduction and social progress against the entrenched interests of the army, the private business sector. And of course, and she herself has a foot in the private business sector camp in some sense. Otherwise, she'd never have been able to get to be the winning candidate so far.
Right.
But and she's not regarded as somebody who's in like Jimmy Morales is closely associated with entrenched business interests, corrupt business interests, and the army, and so she's not involved in that kind of totally compromised sector of Guatemala's ruling classes, and obviously she's not somebody that you could say has come up from the grassroots like Thelma Cabrera would be.
Right.
But, you know, and she's in the Guatemalan context, she's probably as good a progressive candidate as you're likely to get.
Yeah.
And so then what will happen in the second round? I think it's very unlikely that Giametti will win. But who knows? You just don't know. And it looks as though Sandra Torres is going to walk it in the second round. And that should give her. It's not clear. I haven't seen the results for the National Assembly in Guatemala, so it's not clear whether she will be well placed to implement whatever legislative agenda she decides to try and push through. But anybody who wins is going to have a very difficult time because Guatemala's problems are so deeply entrenched.
Yeah, I mean, a good part of the economy there. Even for the Americas, including the United States in particular, a good part of the economy there is in the hands of the military directly, right?
Right, absolutely. So, and she's up against these entrenched interests who this time around were not able to mobilize a candidate like they did last time with Jimmy Morales. But and that's one of the reasons why a lot of people in the United States are totally fixated on this 4-year term, and you only get to repeat one term.
Right.
But what can anybody do in 4 years? You know,
right.
And in a context where global capitalism has imposed structures that are so deeply repressive and so incredibly restrictive in policy terms for what a politician, even in a large country, never mind a small country like Guatemala.
Right. Right.
And what? Nobody in 4 years is going to be able to change the system to the point where it's going to make a major difference to the impoverished majority.
Well, you know, it seems that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say that is why here in Nicaragua, the importance of the fact that Daniel Ortega has managed to win re-election twice, never mind all this nonsense about term limits. What's democratic about not being able to vote for the candidate you want?
Right.
You know, and so he won the first election with only 39% of the vote back in 2006, November 2006. Then in 2011, he won with around 62% of the vote. And then in the last, he won with over 70% of the vote. Right. So and he's obviously a candidate that the great majority of people in Nicaragua have confidence in and want to. They want him. It is their democratic right to elect him because he takes care of them.
Yep.
He advances their interests. He reduces poverty. And some friends of ours went to Chile recently. And when they were in Chile, people said, "Oh, what's life like in Guatemala in Nicaragua?" And our friends explained to them, there's universal free health care, there's universal free education, the public transport in Managua for about 1.5 million people is subsidized, people who only use under 150 kilowatts of electricity get an electricity subsidy on their electricity bill. And they reeled off this series of benefits that people get in Nicaragua. And people in Chile, their mouths just hung open.
Right, right. idea about the magic of term limits, because Morales is being term limited out after one term, right? He can't run again for that.
No, you can't stand for re-election in Guatemala.
Exactly.
And I don't think you can in El Salvador either.
So
you didn't used to be able to in Honduras until the coup of 2009 that led eventually to Juan Orlando Hernandez. And what Hernandez did was gerrymander things in the National Congress to change the constitution without even any consultation at all.
No referendum or anything, I know. So here's the thing.
That's why he's able to stand, yeah.
Morales is in for 4 years, okay? So he ran on an anti-corruption platform in a place that, you know, this had all the history of the corruption that they have there. So you can guess that if he was, you know, even half taken seriously by institutional power, that they'd be gunning for him. So that whatever accusations of corruption against him are probably exaggerated. Certainly every instance of corruption would be reported because these actual corrupt people with institutional power would be giving him retribution for daring to try to shake that up in the first place. But if you look at what he's being accused of doing, 4 years isn't even enough to learn how to steal. You know, he was accused of getting an extra $7,300 a month check out of the military. It's like $80,000 a year or something.
Right.
You know, the people that, you know, work the parking lot in some of the government buildings in Washington steal that much out of the glove compartments, for God's sake.
Right.
You know, and like that. Such low, he was sexually abusing young public workers, young female public workers, with the complicity of other government. They didn't say minors, number one. Like, so it's not like the U.S. Congress. You know, with the pages and all that stuff. And he mobilized some troops at the border with Belize because there was a shooting incident on the border. That's it. That's what that's what he stands accused of.
No, and Morales is kind of,
He's a putz. He's a puppet.
He's a little bit pathetic.
Yeah, he is.
You know, because he was just a pawn for the elements of the Guatemalan elite that used him as their vehicle to get into Guatemala's presidential office, and implement policies that they wanted, And as you say, they're just kind of using him like an old rag and throwing him away.
That's right.
And so if you look beyond that, and the fundamental situation in Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras, where Juan Orlando Hernandez is facing very serious popular, and And I think, in effect, it is an uprising, and he is trying to repress it. Mm-hmm. But the dissent and the dissatisfaction and the unrest is so widespread and deep now. It's much deeper even than it was under Porfirio Loba, and who was able to just send out the security forces to crack enough people over the head to make them go away. But that's not happening this time, right. So far. And then, right. And there have been deaths in Honduras, but they're not getting reported.
Right.
Like they were reported in Nicaragua, completely falsely reported and attributed to the police.
Right.
And so something different is happening in Honduras now, and you can, you know, it's just classic. In a country run by a progressive government, the mainstream media, the corporate media in North America and Europe and in the region generally, will demonize the security forces and claim repression.
Of course.
While in Colombia, they're murdering three or four people a week between social activists, community leaders, and former FARC guerrillas who've taken up the peace agreement. But you never read about that.
Right.
And before in Mexico, and you never used to read about the kind of weekly massacres that would happen there, not by the government, but by, you know, and the general disorder in Mexico was of a magnitude many, many times greater than anything that happened in Venezuela, for example. Mm. But you never read about it. You're probably reading more about it now because Mexico now has a progressive president under Andrés Manuel López Obrador. But the point about Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador is that they are firmly in the orbit of the United States, right, and United States regional policy. And what's so paradoxical about that, maybe it's not paradoxical, you probably have a better take in some senses on this than I do, is that you have President Trump screaming about migration, and illegal immigrants. And at the same time, you have them implementing a policy mix, yes, in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala that's designed to send illegal immigrants to the United States.
Right.
You know, and if somebody had set out to design, let's see if we can work out a policy formula
that will send people out of their houses, right? Yep.
Possible.
Yep.
From our region to the United States. Well, that is what somebody has done in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador.
Look at Europe, look at the warning that came from Muammar Gaddafi, that said, "Listen, if you guys take me out, you know, you might as well stand on the piers in Tripoli and sell tickets to Europe and hot dogs, because there's going to be a massive migration through North Africa into Europe." And it's exactly what happened. They blow up Iraq and Syria and Libya, and half of sub-Saharan Africa's at war, you know, one way or another. And those people run away because they don't want to get blown up. And the safest place they can go is the place on the other side of the battle lines. You know, it's like the guys who were shooting at us, let's stand behind them.
Yeah, and the reality in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala is much, in some ways it's more sinister because it's so routine.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at what's happened in Libya, Iraq, and Syria, you're talking about all-out war.
Right, they're extraordinary.
But when you look at what's happening in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, I might be wrong about this, but this is my take on it. When this is routine.
Right.
And it's the routine of unbearable poverty.
Right.
It's the routine of daily intimidation by petty crooks.
Right.
It's the routine of regular extortion. If you're a taxi driver in San Salvador or Guatemala City or in Honduras, you have to pay a tax to the local hoods.
Right.
Because if you don't, they'll beat you up. They'll hurt your family. They'll burn your car.
Mexico.
If you're a bus driver, they'll machine gun the bus full of passengers.
Yeah.
And so that is the horrific routine reality that people are fleeing from.
Yep.
In El Salvador, Honduras, and never mind the absolutely grinding poverty.
Right.
And But when you combine the grinding poverty with that systematic criminal intimidation and and the complete lack of security, and that is just a recipe for let's get out of here.
I mean, the murder rates now, in those places, it might as well be military instead of irregular actions that's going on with the drug killings, with the death squads, because there are death squad killings in those countries also. You know that from losing some of your own friends even. And so, you know, the nature of, I mean, look, the thing that they have in common in each case, these are the victims of imperialism on the ground, you know, in the colonial countries, whether they're conducting a war, an overt war in their country today, or they're conducting a war against the people in the country as they strip out their assets, like we see happening across the Western Hemisphere and everywhere that the U.S. has been able to weasel its way back in. So you have people escaping poverty and violence in one fashion or another in each place, and that's the common thing, with the sources of that violence and exploitation ending up as the destination countries because they happen to be close.
Right. Yeah, and I imagine if Haiti weren't an island, imagine if Haiti were attached to
Florida.
Right,
that's right. That border would be impossible to you'd have to build a wall to the moon for there. People would be climbing on each other's back.
And the aim of the United States elites and the governments that they own, year in, year out, doesn't matter whether it's a Democratic administration or a Republican administration.
Not at all.
The policy that the U.S. elites implement is designed to impoverish more and more countries like Haiti, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. That contradiction is something I just don't understand.
Yeah.
Because... And at the same time as they're impoverishing these countries, they're then obviously, as you said in relation to Muammar al-Gaddafi's warning to the NATO countries when they were attacking him, and what they're doing is creating a massive problem for their own population, right?
Yep.
It's a conundrum for me. I don't understand it.
The outcome of it has been, number one, it drives wages down in the imperial countries, because you have all kinds of new labor, people coming in under severe distress. You know, you want us to send you back to Syria where you can get blown up, or you want to work here in the shadows, you know, for 8 cents an hour or whatever. Well, okay, there's no bombs going off. I'll stay here for the moment. You have that pressure on local labor markets and all of that. You have the population's, worst impulses under those kinds of conditions being excited in politics. And so you have a huge movement towards the right, in terms of the political. It's tailor-made for a minute elite of people who happen to also be the policymakers.
Right, yeah, because it's the elites that run U.S. policy, isn't it? They've got nothing to do with democratic process.
Right.
So and that is why in the region, in the Central American region, that's why the United States and the European Union demonize Nicaragua, because Nicaragua has done. Looking back at what I was saying to you earlier on about our friends and the reaction to what they were telling people in Chile. And that is what the corporate media are trying to crush and repress. They don't want people to know about all that
stuff.
Right,
that's right.
They don't want people to know that Nicaragua is the most successful country in Central America, which is a very low bar.
Right.
I know it's a very low bar. But regardless of that, Nicaragua is streets ahead of its neighbors in terms of social policy,
right,
and that includes Costa Rica, because in Costa Rica's undergoing its most serious social crisis since probably the end of the Second World War, and when they were having a virtual civil war, and now under the current president, I think it's Carlos Alvarado, and he's a social democrat with neoliberal policies. He has nothing to offer the majority of the population in Costa Rica, and he's facing serious unrest there as well. So in terms of the region as a whole, Nicaragua stands out as a model. In fact, I was writing about this yesterday. I began writing an article about why is it that the narcissist left, the neo-colonial left in North America and Western Europe, are blind to the achievements of Nicaragua in the current context? And there's no other country, with the exception of Cuba, Venezuela, and Bolivia, in the region that has been so successful in the global context of extremely repressive corporate capitalism and all the policies associated with it. And they're outright offensive against anything that smacks of national sovereignty. No other country apart from the ALBA countries, Venezuela, Cuba, Bolivia, and Nicaragua, has been as successful. And in the Central American region, certainly no country can hold a candle to Nicaragua in terms of social progress for its general population. Right. And but if you read anything to do with Nicaragua in North America or Western Europe, in either in the right-wing press or in so-called progressive media, they all demonize Daniel Ortega as some kind of dictator and portray Nicaragua as some kind of dictatorial hellhole. It's just ridiculous. No. And so, and when for people to understand how ridiculous it is, you just have to look at what's happening in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, and compare it with the reality in Nicaragua. And the problem is that nobody ever reports the reality in Nicaragua.
That's right.
So there, and that's in the regional context. Stepping back from looking at the Central American region, you can see that there's a sense in which the kind of chaos that the United States has imposed on the so-called Northern Triangle here in Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and they're trying to impose that across the region too, but with the resistance against it, the resistance against that corporate neoliberal offensive has been surprisingly strong. And so in Venezuela, and a lot of people wrote off Venezuela and thought, well, and the Maduro government will fold within a few weeks, and then Juan Guaido will take over, and the United States will have their puppet government that they've been struggling for 20 years now. Well, that hasn't happened, and it looks right. as though it's not going to happen. Right. And it looks as though Nicolas Maduro is going to manage to cope with all the difficulties that he's been facing, and see out his electoral period. And when is it now? 2025 is the next election. But by that time, it'll be the United States that's in deep crisis, because the United States is unable to resolve the contradictions generated by its failure to compete with, in particular, with China, but militarily right. also its failure to be able to compete with Russia. So, and all that the progressive governments in Latin America have to do, whether it's Nicaragua, Bolivia, Venezuela, or Cuba, is hold on for 2 or 3 years, and then it's likely to be the case that the United States will be much less able than it is today to ruin outcomes for everybody around the world, and its power is in such rapid decline. It's probably in 2 or 3 years, it's going to be unlikely to ruin positive outcomes, even for its target countries here in Latin America. Well, so, and that's my that you can see that in Brazil. And look at what's happening in Brazil. Bolsonaro's a joke.
Yeah, he's in trouble too.
A sinister joke. Yep. That's true. But his government is completely unsustainable. Yeah. And the lies that Sergio Moro used, the gross irregularities that he engaged in order to falsely imprison
Lula, to keep him out of the election. We got to stop here because we're out of time. But I would love to have a conversation about that and some of the revelations about some of the people around Guaido in Venezuela as well, which have come out. And we'll pick it up there next week. Tony, thank you very much.
Okay, it's me and Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.